This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm a congregational rabbi, which means two things. One, if you close your eyes and drift off to sleep, I'll feel right at home. So please be comfortable. Number two, I learned long ago in the congregational rabbinate that you always give the end of the sermon first because they might not be awake by the end. So here's the end of the sermon. I'm going to give you the thesis at the beginning, and that way you can drift off the rest of the evening and enjoy yourself. When we tell the story of the Jewish people, we typically tell it as a story of continuity. We gain a sense of our authenticity, of the authority of our tradition, from that idea of tradition, that we are part of a chain of generations, passing down values, symbols, ideas from ancient antiquity down through modernity. We are part of a chain of generations. We look back and see Abraham and Sarah as our ancestors, and Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah, and Moses and Aaron and Jeremiah and Isaiah and Hillel and Shammai and Maimonides and the Baal Shem Tov and Theodor Herzl. They're all part of this chain of generations, and we are the next link in the chain. And in the narrative of continuity, which is the dominant narrative of our Judaism, the anxiety is, can I pass this on to those who follow me? Will my descendants be as loyal to this tradition as my ancestors were? Or as Adin Steinsaltz once said, the definition of a Jew is anybody worried about whether his or her grandchildren will be Jewish. The idea that there's worry in that definition is certainly true, but the idea that it's about transmission, that is the anxiety that accompanies a narrative of continuity. Under the narrative of continuity, leadership does not mean originality or initiative or inventiveness. Leadership means accepting what you got from the past, not messing with it too much, and passing it on as whole as you can to those who come after you. Creativity is in your ingenuity in passing it on, not in the content of what you pass on. Continuity means don't mess with it. That is the dominant narrative of contemporary Jewish life. And I want to suggest that there's a second narrative, which is even more important, but we don't speak about it as often. And it fits contrapuntally with the first narrative, dialectically with the first narrative. And that is a narrative of discontinuity, which is to say that at certain key moments in the history of our people, our faith, and our culture, events from outside or developments from inside necessitated a complete reinterpretation of the whole project, a complete reinterpretation of Jewish values, a reinvention of Jewish institutions, a re-understanding of the mission and purpose of Jewish life in the world. And that the reason we were successful in surviving this long wasn't only the loyalty that we expressed through continuity, but the ingenuity, resilience, and creativity that came along at moments of discontinuity. At that moment, certain quality of leadership is called for. It's a leadership that has a tremendous amount of courage, because it takes tremendous amount of courage to recognize that what got us here ain't going to get us there. That the forms of the past, the institutions of the past, the expressions of values from the past can't move forward. And that loyalty to those institutions and those forms, a sort of slavish loyalty to those institutions and forms, is going to kill us. It takes that kind of courage. It takes a certain kind of ingenuity to imagine what might be next. What might be next? And it takes a culture of experimentation, a sort of permission to experiment to figure out what might be next. The wonderful thing, by the way, about Jewish history is to look at all of the experiments that didn't work. Christianity. Well, that worked, but not for us. You might have seen that it's working. Just go outside. I mean, think of Christianity as an attempt to reformulate Judaism in the wake of destruction. It didn't work for us, but it worked really well for the rest of the world. And lots of other experiments. But we gave ourselves permission to experiment. Creativity, courage, and wisdom, like in the word of the AA prayer, to know what to change and what not to change and how to live with that. A certain sense of knowing what was the repertoire of institutional expressions and values that came from the past that could be advanced in the future. This moment, in these moments of discontinuity, we have been very fortunate. This, some would say it's providential, that at those moments we had those kind of leaders who could step up and make that determination. The most famous one, of course, is in the year 70, when the temple is destroyed, and all the institutions and all the symbols of Jewish continuity are gone. Had the community at that moment simply said, let's just wait, maybe God will rebuild the temple, we would have died as a people. But the truth is, this happened over and over again. Here's the most interesting thing. The most interesting books of the tradition were not written in moments of continuity. They are the products of those revolutions of discontinuity. Because if you're living in a moment of continuity, you don't need to write a book. You just say, we do what Zeta did. We did what Bubba did. It's only when you're dealing with discontinuity that you got to sit down and figure out what comes next. And that's how the Bible got written. The Bible's written first under the Exodus from Egypt and then the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem in 586. And then you have the destruction of the Temple again and you have the creation of the Talmudic tradition. And then you have the confrontation with philosophy and with the intellectual traditions of Arab culture. And you have the creation of Maimonides. And then you have the destruction of Spanish Jewry and the exile of Sephardic Jewry all over the Mediterranean, and you get the Kabbalistic tradition, Lurianic Kabbalah. And then you have the destruction of European Jewry the first time in the 17th century, and you have the rise of Hasidism. And then you have the destruction of European Jewry the second time in the early 20th century, and you have Zionism. And now, and here's my thesis, we're living through the mother of all moments of discontinuity. The reason why Jewish life is so filled with anxiety today is because we're living through a profound moment of discontinuity. Literally, nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows which values to put forward. Nobody knows what those values are supposed to mean. Professor Hecht and I were talking over dinner. He teaches a class on Jewish identity. 13 sessions at the University of California, Santa Barbara, on Jewish identity. First of all, that's a miracle. I mean, my Zeta would never have understood that. But the idea that you go 13 sessions in a university, an upper-level university class, and still can't answer the question, what does it mean to say I'm Jewish, tells you that we're living through a moment of profound discontinuity. And my thesis tonight is, don't worry. I know that's hard for Jews to hear. Because Jews love to worry. That's what someone once said that what oil is to Arabs, worry is to Jews, right? So if I say, don't worry, you're going to get excited. You're going to say, no, you don't know what you're talking about, Rabbi. I read the Pew study. Me too. I read it every night before I go to sleep. I read it to my children. The reason I say don't worry is simply this. If you know the history of this people, you understand that we have always been able to muster the resilience, the creativity, and the courage to figure it out. And we can figure this one out too. The crisis we're going through today is a crisis called modernity. Modernity didn't start with the Holocaust. It didn't start with the 20th century. It started approximately 300 years ago. There is a document which I would like to share with you, which I think is the most revealing document, which opens up for us a perspective on modernity. Now, I know this is a lecture sponsored by a university, so I'm supposed to bring you an arcane, strange source translated from an ancient language that nobody ever reads, that I found in the back of a journal that nobody ever reads, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to bring you a species of popular culture because I think this does the job really well, and that is Fiddler on the Roof. Fiddler on the Roof. Sounds crazy, no? But in our little village of Anatevka, you might say every one of us is a fiddler on the roof trying to scratch out a little tune without breaking his neck. Fiddler on the Roof opened in 1964 on Broadway and became one of the most popular Broadway shows in all of American theater history. Fiddler on the Roof is based on a set of stories written by the Yiddish author Shalom Aleichem called Tevye and His Daughters. It's about Tevye and his five daughters. The play's about the first three. Don't ask about the last two, but the first three. Fiddler on the Roof is a picture of, well, the world before the crisis and the world after the crisis. What was the world before the crisis like? Well, that I can tell you in one word. Oh, that was your cue and you screwed it up. Come on, guys. How do we keep our... Why do we stay in Anatevka if it's so dangerous? Because that's our home. Anatevka, by the way, is any place in the old world, in Eastern Europe, where many of us came from. And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in one word... That's much better. Tradition. Because of our traditions, everyone knows who he is and what God expects him to do. I gave you the words here. You want to try to sing with me? Are we allowed to do that in a university lecture? Professor Rothbard is a professor of music, so maybe he'll forgive me for this, right? So forgive me for this, professor, right? Tradition, tradition, dum-da-rum-dum-dum-da-rum-dum-dum, tradition. Tradition, tradition, dum-da-rum-dum-dum-da-rum-dum-dum, tradition, bum-bum-bum-bum. I don't think anyone sung this song in this library ever, right? This doesn't strike me as a philo-Semitic building, but all right. I need all the gentlemen in the room. Would all the gentlemen in the room help me with this? Ready? Who day and night must scramble for a living, feed a wife and children, say his daily prayers, and who has the right as master of the house to have the final word at home together? The papa, tradition, the papa, tradition. Now you see why I'm the rabbi and the four cantors are coming next week, right? Ladies, ready? All the women in the room, please, ready? And who must know the way to make a proper home, a quiet home, a kosher home? Who must raise a family and run the home so Papa's free to read the holy books together? The mama, tradition. The mama, tradition. Dum, 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 dum. Gentlemen, at 3, I started Hebrew school. At 10, I learned a trade. I hear they've picked a bride for me. I hope, bump, bump, she's pretty. The sun, tradition. The sun, tradition. Bump, 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 bump. Ladies, and who does mama teach to mend and tend and fix? Preparing me to marry whoever papa picks. The daughter, tradition. The daughter, tradition. Bump, 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 bump. Now there's a round, but we're not going to do it. But thank you for indulging me. You were really good. I just wanted to say you're really good. This is hyperbole. This is dramatic. But this sets out an outline of the pre-modern situation. What is the pre-modern cultural situation? There is fundamentally no such thing as an independent self. The independent self is totally embedded in a world of community, of family, and of tradition. The locus of authority, the place that tells us what to do and how to live, is the family, the community, and God, basically. And we don't make our own decisions. You were born, raised, grew up, got old, died within 100 miles, culturally as well as geographically. You were within a circle that defined you, that was very narrow. And your script, your life script, was determined for you before you were born. If your father was a tailor, you were going to grow up to be a tailor. If your father was a butcher, you were going to grow up to be a butcher. Unless, of course, you were a woman, in which case you were going to be a wife and a mother no matter what your aptitudes. That's hyperbole. It's not exactly a snapshot of pre-modern society, but not bad. Not far off. And in the play, of course, even the most intimate decisions are not given to the self. Even the most intimate decisions, namely who you're going to marry and live with your whole life, is given over to the community. So, of course, the most powerful person in the community is Yenta the matchmaker. It's very funny because the word yenta in Yiddish means a gossip. And who knows more gossip than the matchmaker, right? Now, Tevye has five daughters. In that culture, what gave you capital on the marriage marketplace? Three things. One, you were related to a great rabbi. That's called yichus. I have three children. Let's talk, right? Number two, if you had money, a girl had a dowry. So every woman is beautiful on the day of her wedding, but a woman with 100,000 shares of Apple stock is positively ravishing. And number three is if you were physically attractive, if you were attractive. And pretty much women got married at age 16 and men got married at age 18. Tevye has five daughters, and his oldest daughter, Tzaitl, is a little overripe. She's 19 years old, Nebuchadnezzar not married. Because she's not related to anybody, there's no yichus in this family, because Tevye is dirt poor, so there's no money, and she's a very nice girl. She's a very nice girl, but she's not married. And she can't find anybody. And Yenta comes into the town, into the homestead, and says, I have found a match for your daughter, Tzaitl. And Tevye and Goldie, mother and father, are elated. Who is she going to marry? The butcher, Laser Wolf. Now, the butcher, Laser Wolf, is Tevye's age, age of her father. And he's a widower, probably more than once, because a lot of women died in childbirth. And he's a drunk. And he's a violent drunk. He's actually not violent when he's drunk, but he's violent when he's sober, right? And so why would this be a match that you'd want your daughter to have? For one reason. Why? He's money, and not just money. She won't starve. This is literally a starvation economy. So the fact that she won't starve living in, and you'll have grandchildren who will have what to eat, this is a wonderful match. So Tevye goes off to the local tavern and ties one on with the local Russian peasantry, and they sing to life, l'chaim, nostravia, and they drink a lot of Russian vodka. And on his way back, stoned out of his mind, drunk out of his mind, he meets Seitel at the gate of the homestead, and she says, Papa, Papa, thank you. And he says, Seitel, Seitel, you're going to get married, mazel tov. And she said, no. I refuse the match. Girls could refuse the match, although no one ever did, except Seidel. And she said, and he says, what do you mean you refuse the match? She said, I'm promised to somebody else. He said, what do you mean you're promised to somebody else? Who promised you to somebody else? I'm your father. And she said, we did it ourselves. And he said, oh, really? You did it yourselves? And who told you you could do it yourselves? And she said, Papa, this is the new way. So he says, out of curiosity, now he's stone sober, right? And he says to her, who are you promised to? You're going to give up a match with a rich Laser Wolf? Who are you promised to? And she says, the tailor, Muttel Kemzoil. The unaccomplished, skinny, starving tailor, Muttel Kemzoil, who was an orphan. And Tevye brought him into the household to raise him. So Tzaitl and Motel were raised like brother and sister in the same home, and they fell in love. They fell in love. And he says to her, this is the most important question. This is the beginning of the revolution. You're going to give up a match with Laser Wolf to marry a skinny, unaccomplished, starving tailor? Why on earth would you want to do that? And she says, Papa, because I love him. To which he answers with the immortal words of the great sage Tina Turner. What's love got to do with it? What's love but a secondhand emotion? What do you mean you love him? So what? You don't marry for love. Love has nothing to do with marriage. You marry out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of responsibility, out of a sense of obligation, out of a sense of commitment to the God of the tradition. That's what you marry. You marry to create a family and a home. You don't marry with love. And she says to him, no, Papa, the world has changed. Today we marry for love. This is the first element of modernity, the birth of a choosing self. Because at that moment, what happens is that the locus of authority has been drawn from God and community and family into the self. I will choose my own path in my life. You will not tell me what I am and what I am to do. This is modernity number one. The birth of the autonomous choosing self. And it's remarkable that that romantic love is the symbol of that. Because if you think about it, romantic love is a sort of shaky foundation to put anything on, much less marriage, much less a whole culture and civilization, and yet that's what we do. Romantic love is what this is all about. It is a feeling. It is subjective. It is an emotion. And yet that's going to be the beginning. So what is modernity, according to Peter Berger, the sociologist? The watchword of modernity, he wrote a book called The Heretical Imperative, in which he said the word heresy really means choice. You come to America, you have choice, right? In the old world, if your father was a tailor, you became a tailor. If your father was a butcher, you became a butcher. In America, which is modernity writ large, that's where we met modernity. In America, if your father's a tailor, you become a lawyer. If your father was a butcher, you become a doctor. If your father was a lawyer, you become a poet. You know, I mean, that's how it works in America. Right? In America, you are not committed to become the person that you have been ascribed to be. I'll prove this to you. Some of you are my age. You remember. The first great national television commercial campaign, advertising campaign, was for a product called Clairol hair coloring. The people at Clairol invented a way to color your own hair. You didn't have to do it in a salon. So in the 1950s and early 1960s, there were these TV commercials. And a woman with a big smile on her face, because obviously all of her problems have been solved by Clairol, gets on. She says, "If I have only one life, let me live it as a..." That's shame on you for remembering that. That hasn't been on the air for 50 years, and you remember that. Wait, what's even worse? Why? Because it's true that blondes have more... Blondes have more fun. You don't even know what we're talking about. There's a device in our living room called a television. It used to have 7 channels on it, right? There were TV commercials that were played in between the programs, and one of them was for a product that changed your hair color, and Clairol said, "If I have only one life, let me live it as a blonde." But you see, what that really is isn't about hair color. That's modernity. If I have only one life, let me live it as a fill-in-the-blank. In the profession I choose, in the politics I choose, in the geography I choose, in the lifestyle I choose. Whatever I want, I choose. I am not going to consign myself to the script written for me by my parents. That's modernity. When I first moved, I moved back to L.A. I lived in Texas and I lived in New York for many years. And I moved back to L.A. in 1990 and I was driving down Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles. And there was a huge billboard for a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon. It actually showed this woman whom somebody had blessed, right? Either God or that surgeon, I think. And it advertised $3,500. I didn't know if that was each or for the set. I'm not sure. But I almost cracked up the car because, and I have nothing against cosmetic surgery. It's very important in some cases. But just for a moment, imagine you're not fated to live with the physiognomy you were born with. I mean, just imagine this. Let me put it in plain Yiddish. You don't have to live with the tuchus you were born with. You want it bigger, you want it smaller, we can make it like Scarlett Johansson, whatever you want. I mean, this idea that choice has come to that is a remarkable emblem of the larger culture of the choosing self. That's modernity number one. Now, right away, you see the problem that Tevye is pointing to. Tevye has to decide if he can live with his daughter married to that kind of individualism. And you can see the problem that Shalom Aleichem is pointing to. Can Judaism survive in an atmosphere of free choice? After all, the lingua franca, the language of Judaism, is a language of mitzvah, of obligation. And the question is, can you build a Jewish identity? Can you build a Jewish community out of people who say, "It's my choice. It's always my choice"? That's going to be a very interesting question. But we're not done yet. The second daughter, you remember what happens? They get married. Now, there was a young man who came into Tevye's homestead during the years of the engagement, and his name was Perchik, and he was running away from the Tsar's police. Remember that? So at Seidel and Muttel's wedding, they did get married. I'm afraid to give away the end, but they did get married. He crosses the mechitza, the barrier that separated men from women, and he starts dancing with Huddle, which is the second daughter with whom he'd fallen in love. And everyone says, "Oh!" And then Tevye says, what the hell, New World, walks over, takes Goldie, and they start dancing, and pretty soon all the men and all the women are dancing with each other. Perchik and Huddle, what happens is Perchik has to continue running away from the Tsar's police because he's part of a revolutionary band in St. Petersburg. He represents the second mode of modernity. The traditional Jewish view of history was that God is the principal actor in history. We're spectators. Our job is to live pious lives and wait for the coming of Messiah. That's what we do. You say this on Saturday night. If you ever make Havdalah, at the end of Havdalah, you sing Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, Bimhera Biyamenu, may it come soon, Yavo Eleinu, Ima Shiach Ben David, let the Messiah come. The coming of Messiah was the redemption that we waited for. But our job is to be pious and wait for that redemption. We're not allowed to effectuate that redemption ourselves. But in the middle of the 19th century, there was a revolution in the Jewish idea of history. And young Jews particularly said, enough! This waiting is undignified. This waiting is passivity in the face of suffering. And they joined a set of revolutionary movements, socialism, communism, Bolshevism, Menshevism, capitalism, and the most famous one of all, Zionism. It's hard to believe now because in our communities today, Israel is an emblem of everything that we hold dear, more or less. But Zionism was once a radical break from Judaism. A radical break because what it said was, I'm not waiting anymore. I refuse to wait for God's redemption. I'm going to go and liberate our homeland all by myself. And Perchik represents that move. Perchik represents that move. The second great move of modernity is I take control of the conditions of my own existence and I will shape history to fit my desires. The empowerment of the human being. And the question that Tevye is asking is, can my Judaism be married to that? What happens to my whole sense of history? How do you read the Passover story if you understand that it's our obligation to shape the conditions of our own existence? And Shalom Aleichem's great question was, what becomes of the Jewish aspiration to redemption, to a God of history, if a God of history is supplanted by human historical actions? And then the Holocaust comes and makes all of that complicated. The third daughter, Chava. So interesting. Her name is Chava. So Chava is Eve in the Bible, right? And what did Eve do in the Bible? Well, you all remember that story, right? She ate of a fruit. Why? Because it promised her knowledge. And what is Chava? She's the girl with the book in front of her face. And she always wanted to read. And so they gave her the keys to the libraries. And the library was attached to the church. So she went to the library, and who'd she meet? Fietka, the little Russian boy. And they fell in love. Who does Chava represent? What does Chava represent? She is the emblem of the third element of modernity, which is the opening of the Jewish mind. For the Jewish Middle Ages, except for people, extraordinary people like Maimonides, Jews only talked to other Jews. If you're only talking to other Jews, there's things you can say to each other that you don't say when you're outside. But once you expose yourself to the outside, the conversation radically changes. I once had an Egyptian friend come to my Passover Seder. Made it very uncomfortable. Because at every page she said, oh, come on, guys, give me a break. You know, 10 plagues. All right, come on. 5 wouldn't have been enough for you guys. Come on. It changes the way that you think about the whole thing. Like, we can say things to ourselves like, we are chosen people. Yeah, except, you know, it's... So what happens is, what Chava represents is the breaking of the walls of the ghetto, the cognitive ghetto, and an opening of the Jewish mind. And the question here is, what happens to our identity in the face of an onrush of European culture? So you have David Hume, whose empiricism calls into question all the miracles that we talk about, right? And then you have Copernicus, who says you're not the center of the universe. You're the third planet in a medium-sized yellow sun in the suburbs of a Milky Way galaxy that has 100 million stars, and there are 100 million galaxies just like it. Mazel tov. So, all right, so now we're out there, right? And then you get Charles Darwin, who comes along and says, what, created in the image of God? You're just a highly developed, less than hairy monkey. You're a primate. You have 99.9% of your chromosomes are the same as the chimpanzee in the zoo. And you say, okay, but it's the human spirit. Yeah, and then comes Durkheim, who tells you that every people call themselves a chosen people. Every tribe, the Polynesians, the Aborigines, the Navajos call us Goyim. I have a Navajo friend. He says, it's nice being with you, Goyim, every now and again. He learned my vocabulary, you know. He says, Machai, he says, you're a non-Navajo. I said, you're a non-Jew. He says, all right, we're even, you know. You know, and then comes Freud, and he says the human spirit is governed by eros and thanatos, by your sexual desires and your murderous desires. And then come Marx, who says that religious ideological infrastructures are governed by your access to the means of production. And what's left of us? What's left of the truth claims of a Jewish tradition, of any religious tradition, in the wake of modern skepticism? And this is interesting, by the way, because if you know the play or the movie is different than the play, by the way. If you know the play, in the play, Tevye could live with the marriage of Seidel to Mottl. And he could live with Huddle going to Siberia to meet Perchik. But he couldn't live with Chava running away with Fiatka. So he realized that there's some things you can't live with. In the movie, he sort of, remember, they did a gesture at the end, come with us. So you know, that's the Americanized version of the movie, of the story. Can Judaism live with cognitive openness? That's the great question he's asking. Can Judaism live in the marketplace of contemporary ideas and still have a claim on people's hearts? This is the story of Fiddler on the Roof. The irony of Fiddler on the Roof is everybody loves the movie. Everybody loves the play. In 1964, when it first opened, it was this crazy. Everybody went to go see it. It's played at every wedding. I do weddings for a living. If you don't play Sunrise, Sunset, it's nicht kosher. It's not kosher. It's just not kosher. It's part of our liturgy now, right? Is this the little girl? And yet, everyone thinks that Fiddler on the Roof is a poem, it's a paean to tradition. It's really about the forces that came and undid tradition. It's about the forces that came in and dismantled tradition. And the irony is that in 1964, when the play opened, right, that was the sort of peak of American Jewish prosperity and power. We had arrived in 1886, between 1886 and 1920, we arrived in this country from Eastern Europe. And within two generations, we made it to the top of the American pyramid. We are the most efficient manipulators of American modernity of any ethnic group in the history of this country. In other words, modernity was really good for us, and we were really good at modernity, and everyone goes to this play to cry nostalgically over tradition in Anatevka, a place none of you would want to live, by the way, but nice to cry over. And that's the irony of Fiddler on the Roof. But there's a deeper sense of this. Here's the deeper sense of this. What Shalom Aleichem pointed out to us in that play, and in the novel, in the book, is that it's not just about us. It's also about modernity itself. Those three moments, individualism, cycle, our sense of taking control of empowerment, control of the conditions of our own existence, which is Huddle, and cognitive openness, which is Chava. Those are elements of modernity. If you follow the path of each of those moments, you end up in a paradoxical place. They each end up canceling out themselves. Let me just show you how this works. And I think this is implied in Shalom Aleichem's treatment in the books. Seitel stands for our individualism. Our individualism becomes so dear by us that it becomes a motto. The sociologists, starting with Robert Bella in Berkeley and then later Steve Cohn, and not the other Steve, the other Steve Cohn, the sociologist, and Arne Eisen, called it the sovereign self. The sovereign self is the radical individualist who says, I will not join. You can't get me to join. The sovereign self engages every relationship as a threat, because if I engage in a relationship, then the other has a claim on me, and I'm uncomfortable allowing that person to have a claim on me. So when the sovereign self, or let me put this in more graphic words, when the young couple comes to my synagogue, they come as a consumer. They come wearing the guise of a consumer, because as a consumer, I can control the transaction. As a consumer, what I'm looking for is a limited liability contract. I'm not looking for commitment. Right? And that's what happens in a culture of radical individualism. A young man comes to see me about getting, you know, he's in his late 20s, early 30s, and he's looking for a mate. And he's telling me how frustrating it is to find a woman to marry in Los Angeles, right? And I say, well, tell me about what you're looking for. And he starts listing all these things, and I realize that it's a shopping list. He's not looking for friendship, for a soulmate, for companionship. He's looking for someone who checks, the language is, checks all my boxes, right? On the dating profiles, that's right? On the dating profiles, they ask you for all the check boxes I want, right? I want someone who's tall and blonde and traditional and good-humored and can cook well. And then you realize that what he's looking for, he's not looking for commitment, he's looking to buy a companion. This is the language that he's grown with, and that's why he's having such a difficulty in a situation of bonding. The paradox of individualism is that it leaves you all by yourself. It leaves you lonely and alienated. It precludes the opportunity to really achieve anything as a human being, because it calls into question every human relationship. The paradox of empowerment is that when Jews were believing in a Messiah who would come, we had a pretty good idea of what that looked like. But once I say, I'm going to create my own Messiah. I'm going to be my own Messiah. I'm going to bring redemption myself. I'm going to assume the power to achieve my own redemption. The question is, well, what does that look like? What does that look like? I mean, one of the really interesting aspects of contemporary Jewish life, and we can talk about this when I'm done, is Zionism. I mean, the early Zionists had a pretty good idea. They had this utopian vision of what Israel would be. And that's all but been beaten out of us now by the realism of Israel. Well, it's got security issues, and it's got economic issues, and it's got all kinds of issues. But where is the aspirational language that went with it? How do you know what it is you want once you have the power to get it? That's the paradox of empowerment. And the paradox of cognitive openness. Every one of us prizes the opportunity to read and to encounter ideas and to listen to ideas that are far and wide, to a variety of cultures. I don't know how many of you, I'm going to offend the professor here, but how many of you have ever sent a kid to an American university? Have you had that experience yet? This is a wonderful experience. You have a child that you've invested all this time, energy, money in giving them a set of values, and you send them to an American university. So the poor kid gets to the university, and they spend they come back right now at Thanksgiving. You guys going home for Thanksgiving? Yeah. You come home for Thanksgiving, and the kid walks into your house, and they're barely recognizable. And you say, you know, Rochel, Sarah, you know, Avram, Chaim, how was college? And the kid says, don't call me that imperialist white bourgeois name. Call me by my Native American name, right? Right? Green feather, you know. The old joke was, Mama, don't worry, we're giving the kid a Jewish name. He's going to be called Whitefish. You know, that was the old joke. You know, and the kid has piercings and tattoos and tells you that all of your bourgeois values are so, you know, deracinated and empty and hollow and hypocritical. And you say, kid, it's those bourgeois values that are paying your tuition. You know, you don't think you don't like my bourgeois values? Pay your own damn tuition, you know? But what happens is universities, I think, are set up to do this. Because the atmosphere on a university campus has to be complete openness. Complete openness to every expression of the human spirit. Openness to values, openness to lifestyles, openness to politics, openness to ideas. That's great on a university campus, but you can't live in complete openness because you can't live in utter universalism. At some point, you've got to make a choice. You've got to make it. Oh, by the way, he's a vegan. So God help you making a turkey for Thanksgiving. You know, it's either a tofurkey or whatever they call it now. But what? Yeah, I mean, it's because so you say to the kid, I respect the openness of the university, and I'm glad that you're thriving in that environment. But don't make fun of me. I've made my value choices. You're going to have to make value choices at some point also. And the question is, does the cognitive openness of the university, its radical openness, does that allow somebody to make choices at some point? Or does it preclude all choices because all choices are too narrow? What I'm suggesting is that these moments, modernity has been a real gift to us. It's been a gift to us as Jews, it's been a gift to us as Americans, it's a gift to us as moderns. But there are certain paradoxes built into modernity that lead to consequences which are difficult to deal with. Now, in the 20th century, there rose a group of thinkers. Martin Buber, born in 1865 in Budapest, moves to Vienna, moves to Lemberg, actually, in Eastern Europe, where he's raised by his grandfather. All of these guys have the same biography. They have the same biography. They come from the world of a deep world of Jewish tradition, deeply rooted in the world of Jewish tradition. Buber is going to be raised by his grandfather, who is a great rabbinic scholar. Heschel is going to come from the world of Hasidism. His father was a Hasidic Rebbe of a community. Then when his father died, his uncle took over the community, and Heschel was supposed to be the next Rebbe of the community. Soloveitchik comes from the aristocracy of Lithuanian Talmud study. They all come from the deep world of Jewish tradition and then cross the boundary and enter the world of modernity through the universities of Berlin. Buber ends up doing his doctorate in Berlin and teaching in that university, then teaching in Frankfurt. Heschel does his doctorate in Berlin. Soloveitchik does his doctorate in Berlin and then comes to America. All of them meet modernity through academics, through the academic study of philosophy. All of them are fish out of water. They are people with a deep sense of religiosity and a deep sense of tradition living in a secular society that doesn't understand them. Doesn't understand them. Soloveitchik is going to write a very important essay called The Lonely Man of Faith, where he starts out by saying, nobody understands why I'm doing what I'm doing. Heschel is going to say religion defeated itself by losing touch with the important questions it came to answer. Buber is going to talk about being left out because he realizes that he's pursuing the wrong thing when he's pursuing religion. He's pursuing a caricature of religion. All of them are going to offer thought in the same basic model. It's a dualistic model. For Buber, there's all of life is about our relationships, and there's two kinds of relationships, I-thou and I-it. Modernity, he's going to teach us, privileges I-it. But the real part of being a human being is to develop a sense of I-thou. Heschel is going to talk about our conventional ways of thinking, and then a sense which is built into each of us but not developed well in modernity called a sense of the ineffable. Ineffable means that which you cannot say. In other words, we each have a sense for realities which we can't describe. And Soloveitchik is going to talk about two different readings of the first chapters of Genesis, Adam 1 and Adam 2. One which represents man in his quest for power, human beings in their quest for power, and the other is a different kind of human stance toward the world, a stance which is, we'd say, existential, a stance which accepts defeat and understands that in sublimating my need for power, in surrendering to something bigger than myself, I gain a sense of my own meaning. That structure of thought is going to occur in all of them. So really quickly, Zeitl's triumph was celebrating the sovereign choosing self. But Zeitl's flaw was that if it's all about me choosing what I want, how do I ever break out of the solipsism of my individuality and reach across to another human being? So comes along Buber and says, all real life is meeting. Buber tells a story in his autobiography that a student had come to him one day. He was a professor in the university, and he was practicing Buddhist meditation.
And all morning he had a beautiful meditation. I mean, a really good meditation. Some of you meditate and you can appreciate what that's like. And then it came time for his office hours. So there's a knock at the door, so he has to, like, you know, extinguish the incense and roll up the rug and get up. And this, a student came to see him, to ask him a question. And he writes in his autobiography, he said, "I was polite to him, I was friendly, I answered all of his questions, only I never guessed the question he didn't ask." And then he said, "I found out later from his friends that he had died." Now, we always thought it was something like the kid was going to commit suicide. It turns out, we know now what it really was. The kid was an only child. It was the beginning of the First World War. He wanted to enlist in the German army. His mother didn't want him to enlist. He wanted to know, what's more important, my loyalty to my mom or my loyalty to my fatherland? And Buber didn't guess the question. Buber thought it was an abstract philosophical question, and that's how he answered it. He answered it like a good professor would answer it. He didn't understand that the kid had come to him in that moment for a deep existential choice. And he says, "I realize something." That's what life is. It's about the encounters we have with each other. It's about being present. It's in every moment we are given an opportunity to be present to the other. And it's from that that he develops his philosophy of I-thou, which is, most of the time we engage in relationships which are purely functional. The bank teller, the supermarket checker, the waitress, the security guard. But every now and again we break through that shell, and I get to know the other person, and I realize that the other person is not there as a function to check my groceries or to deposit my check. That person is there to be encountered, to be met, to be acknowledged. That's the moment that matters. That's the only human moment where we gain a sense of our purpose in the world. And he says modernity is flawed because it leaves us without opportunities to have those kind of encounters. Seitel was right to choose the self and to choose a choosing self. But what's ironic in the way that Tevye told the story is that she develops a self because she wants to marry Mutl Kemzoil. It's out of a deep, intimate relationship with the other that I ever get to know who I really am. Which now we know from developmental psychology is actually really the way that children develop a sense of self. They develop a sense of self by working off of the cues of a caretaker, a mother or a father or a mentor. That's how children psychologically develop. The brain, the human brain, is actually set up that way. Deprive young babies of that encounter and the kid grows up warped. That really is how we grow up. Buber was actually sort of anticipated the findings of developmental psychology, but he did this from a spiritual sense. He said, that's Judaism. That's Judaism. What is Judaism? It's all about learning how to encounter the other and understanding the infinite preciousness of the other. And that's what modernity left out. That's what Seitel left out. That's what we leave out when we emphasize the power of the individual. That's Seitel. Hoddle, who is empowered, who wants to remake the conditions of existence, Joseph Soloveitchik would say that's half of the human equation. That's called Adam One. By the way, David Brooks, who's the writer for the New York Times, wrote a wonderful midrash, a wonderful interpretation of Soloveitchik in his book, The Road to Character. I gave you some of it here because it's so good. It's just really good. And he basically says, look, he says, gaining power is one half of the human equation, but it's not the only thing. There's actually a whole other set of values. And it's in this other set of values, not what you get, but what you give, not what you control, but what you nurture. That's where we really gain a sense of purpose and meaning in life. Nothing wrong with gaining power. On the contrary, there's something sacred about gaining power, because as I gain power, I have the possibility of becoming responsible. But that's not the entirety of my human being. And Soloveitchik, and Brooks does a nice job of expressing this, because Soloveitchik is almost unreadable, but Brooks does a nice job of expressing this, points out that that other set of values, what he calls Adam 2, second chapter of Genesis, is really the place of human meaning and purpose. The third thinker, and I know I'm going through this really quickly, and I'd be glad to come back and do this when we talk about it, is Abraham Heschel. Do we have him here? We have, oh, so I see, every other page is here, so all right, good enough.
This is every other page of the handout, but don't worry about it. It's fine. Heschel contrasts two different ways of knowing. There's knowing the stuff that you can express in words, and there's knowing the things you can't express in words. And they're both important. Knowing the stuff you can express in words gives us technical abilities in the world. But knowing the stuff that you can't express in words is the place where human beings become fully human. Heschel used to have a shtick, which I think captures much of his ability, of his vision. He used to start out all of his lectures. He'd look at an audience. He was a little teeny man with gray hair and a big beard. And in a breathless voice with a European accent, he'd say, "Ladies and gentlemen, a great miracle just happened." And the whole audience would be silent, like, "What miracle happened?" He said, "The sun just went down." And that's exactly what happened. People would like laugh. They look at him and say, "He's a lunatic." And then he'd start talking about how does a religious person see the world? Sort of phenomenology of religion. Phenomenology means I'm not going to prove to you the truth of my claims. I'm just going to let you see the world through my eyes. And as he began to talk about how a religious person sees the world, you began to realize that the fact that the sun went down and you didn't run to the window to see it means that something's been lost. He creates a ladder of words to describe that part of us. It talks about wonder and mystery and awe, which are all parts of human experience. They're in the repertoire of human experiences, but and he would say they belong to the foundations of religion. But that's not the kind of technical knowledge that one learns, say, in a university. This is a different way of knowing. And that different way of knowing has to be reclaimed if we're going to be fully human. For Heschel, that different way of knowing had to be reclaimed if we're going to survive as human beings. These great thinkers were not only interested in finding a way to be Jewish in the face of modernity, they were interested in finding a way to be human in modernity, to deal with the paradoxes of modernity without losing our own humanity. Let's finish with one more word from Fiddler, because I know you're dying to sing a little more. So come back to my first page. Come back to my first page. At the end of the play, in the third act, there is this song, which I think is the most charming song in the whole play. It's the daughters are all going, the town is being liquidated, and the daughters are all going off to marry their respective spouses. And Tevye and Goldie are left on the stage alone. I mean, the whole stage has been crowded, the whole play. And all of a sudden, you just have the two of them. And there's this really charming moment. So if I could ask the gentlemen, if you'd all join me in playing Tevye's part. And ladies, if you'd all join me in playing Goldie's part. Okay? Right? Goldie, do you love me? Ladies, do I? Do you love me? Do I love you? With our daughters getting married and there's trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out, go inside, go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion. Goldie, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me? You're a fool, I know. But do you love me? Do I love you? For 25 years I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now? All right, stop a second. So what's going on? We talked about modernity as a sort of line, a sort of crisis. Tevye has crossed the line. Goldie hasn't. In Goldie's world, which is still the world of tradition, your parents decided who you'd marry. In Goldie's world, you marry not for love, but because that's your obligation, your responsibility. Your job is to preserve and protect tradition in the world. Tevye has jumped the line, and he realizes that it's a different world. And the question is, if you weren't compelled, would you still love me? Now, she doesn't understand the question at all, because it's irrelevant. That's not marriage. That's not what marriage is all about, right? It's just not what marriage is all about. Marriage is about fulfilling responsibilities, and I fulfill my responsibilities. Why are you bugging me with love? Why are you bothering me? And his answer is, I just want to know if you love me. I want to know if you weren't compelled, do we have any feelings for me?
right? Would you choose me, right? All right, back to the story, ready? Goldie, gentlemen, the first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared. You missed the cue, guys. I was shy. I was nervous. So was I. But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. And now I'm asking Goldie, do you love me? I'm your wife. I know. But do you love me? Stop it. Now, it's untrue. This is hyperbole. Exaggerated. Usually you didn't meet just on your wedding day. Usually you had a date. Now, it was with your whole family. Right? It was, if anyone have relatives in Israel who live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, in the very Orthodox communities, this is what happens, right? They have a date, right? His family sits on one side of a table, her family sits on the other side of the table, and they can talk to each other across the table, right? With her parents and his parents and uncles and aunts and cousins and 500 yeshiva bechers around. But it's a date. I mean, you know, you've dated, it's a date, right? You know? So it's unusual they wouldn't, but the idea was, what? You didn't have to know each other because we matched you up. You're right. And she says, I don't understand. He says to her, you know, we never had a chance to develop a relationship before we got married. Would you have chosen me? Would you choose me now? Is this something that you want? Is there love here? All right, let's finish. You ready? This is the emotional finish. Do I love him? For 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is? Then you love me. I suppose I do, and I suppose I love you too. It doesn't change a thing, but even so, bump, 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 after 25 years, it's nice to know. I think it changes everything. I think that's wrong. I think that what's really going on here on one level is this man and woman look at each other, and he says, if you weren't part of this structure which forced me on you and you on me, would we find each other in the world? And she says, after 25 years of spending all these moments with you, of course I would. I've come to love you deeply. That's kind of poetic. But the other deeper part is, I think this is a parable, as I pointed out before. This is a parable about Jews and modernity. This is a parable about humanity and modernity. The question of Jews and modernity is, now that we're not in a position where Judaism is forced on us, but is a choice, now that the Jewish people lives in a cognitively open world where every idea is available to us, now that we have the freedom to choose whatever lifestyle we would choose, now that we have the freedom to remake the world in whatever image we choose to remake the world, is there any value in this ancient tradition? Is there any value in this ancient tradition? And the end of the song says, you know, after all this time, I've learned something about this tradition. I've learned its intellectual and moral and aesthetic power. I've learned that this tradition actually does give people a life that's worth living. And so I read this as a parable. The Jewish people says to its tradition, after 3,500 years, I do love you. And it's nice to know that what the thinkers of modernity said was that the gift of Judaism to modernity was a way out of the paradoxes that modern life gave us, a way to live with individualism, a way to live with power, and a way to live with cognitive openness that gives us the possibilities of living meaningful, purposeful lives, and that that's the purpose of a faith like this one in this moment of history. So at this moment of history, I may be the only faithful optimist left in the Jewish people, but I really do believe that we possess the cultural resilience and the cultural creativity to find a way to make Jewish life meaningful in a moment of modernity. And I may be the last one left, but tonight you got to hear me. Thanks so very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.